Piers, we're here in Visual in Carlo, Image, Space and Light, the title of the exhibition running here and at IMA. I suppose the biggest exhibition of Patrick Scott's work that we've seen, bringing pretty much all those decades of work together. And the title seems very appropriate here today, looking out through that wonderful glass at the water, the great space here in Carlo, the light, and surrounded by images. And we're just looking over at this beautiful rainbow image here on the stairs, one of the many works we see here.
A rainbow rug. One of a series he did for Kilkenny Design Workshops, KDW, in the 80s, I think. Edition of 8, I think. And where Pat was fairly true to the spectrum in these ones, he kept with the rainbow.
And it's also a beautiful shape. And I suppose he's a great man for patterns and for these kind of geometrical, these great angles. And you catch that again in the kind of diagonal.
Well, in these rainbow rugs you do, but not so in the other works, in the tapestry work. It's just an exploration of colour and very fluid and very flowing and brave. Tapestry is where he let go with colour. He really had free rein with it and explored the colour almost in opposition to the canvases, the gold canvases. It was a medium that suited him to do this, tufted, woven, and he explored it and enjoyed it and did some very amazing works with it. I think he was facilitated by Scott Tannen Walker in a lot of the commissioning of the... They commissioned most of the works. I think Ronnie had saw that his buildings, the buildings of the firm, which were very modernist and drab and functional, needed something to set them alight and to decorate them and decorate the space. And this was a good relationship for them both.
Mm.
And Pat pretty much had a free hand.
Of course, that's always a great gift for any artist, to have that freedom to do your own work.
Yeah, and to do large-scale work. And the tapestry work that he did was... he seemed to really enjoy it, the large scale. The process that he brought to it was to do a sketch, coloured sketch. And sometimes these were really quite small. The largest of those sketches might be a foot and a half square. He knew a guy down in a canal just off Harrow's Cross, who had a large format camera, and he could take a photograph of that sketch and then give back a scroll, which was a full-size paper print of the sketch. And if that meant it was 20 foot wide by 10 foot high, that's what he got. So in his studio, he'd unroll this slowly, and he would, with a felt pen, create the outline, the separation between the colours. It is that would then go to either Vysotsky Joyce in Galway or to Tabard in Aubusson. And in the case of the Mexican rugs, he would send over to the makers in Oaxaca the sketches that he'd done. And they were much smaller. So that was very interesting to watch him on his hands and knees draw the outline onto paper, which he would never fully see the final result in the studio, because the studio was just too small. And these rolls of paper would invariably get destroyed because they just took up too much room in the studio and so they'd be moved on. Kite, that we're going to look at in the main room, is very much part of that. It was, Kite is the study for Blaze, which was in the Bank of Ireland. It's the same outline.
Is the Bank of Ireland headquarters on Baggot Street?
On Baggot Street. And Blaze was this magnificent blue tapestry, which was unfortunately damaged and has since gone missing because it was supposed to be given to Emma. At least we thought it was given to Emma, but they don't have it. So the damaged remnant is somewhere. So that story isn't over yet. We must find out where that is and see how damaged it is. But Kite was the study for it. And it's on cotton. And in July 76, I think, Pat invited myself and Peter Lamb up to Wicklow to spread it out on the grass and paint in between those outlines. So we spent a weekend doing that, and we thought that was the end of it, but it's since actually now the centrepiece in this exhibition. It belongs to TCD. It hangs there, and they've lent it for the show.
And wonderful it is. Let's actually go down and have a look at that. Yeah, because it's one of the things you see when you walk in. It was this dominant image on the wall of the main gallery, and it's really splendid. I mean, it's so eye catching. And
yeah, there she is. And it's based on his thumbprint. You see the way that's a thumbprint.
Ah, the centerpiece. The edge, the orange. That wonderful orange, yeah. Which is, of course, it is.
That's his thumbprint. And he used that as a motif. There's another piece, tapestry, small, called Lane, that was the Walker family's. And it's also on that motif, his thumbprint. He also did a silk scarf for KDW based on that. So it's a recurring theme in his tapestry work.
And that great kind of burst of almost a fire, that kind of ring, the ring of a flame. So you were painting. You were painting
myself
the
Elizabeth. Painted in that.
Fantastic.
Yeah, in 76. So that's quite some time ago.
So you're here on the wall.
We're here in the wall, kind of. Yeah.
And of course, a lot more here as well. I hadn't seen the meditation tables that are here in this space before. I think they're absolutely wonderful.
They are splendid. They started off by Pat spotting a table in a painting. Now I forget his name. Norwegian painter who painted it was very pictorial stuff. Families at home. And there is that table. He picked up on it. He drew it. Stephen, his godson, who's making some furniture at the time, elected to make those, and well made they are. And Pat said about painting them as meditation tables. When they're upright, you can sit cross-legged and look at them. And there's a little painting at the back for the children for them to enjoy.
Yeah, it's lovely when you see them. Yeah. You get those. Like a little dartboard of colour here. So yes, wonderful, beautiful. What's the wood in those?
The wood
tables?
Is ash. It's all ash. The motifs, the images, they're coming, and you see them on the back of this screen as well. They're coming from an interest that Pat had in Japanese family crests, and that flat image. And there are many of them. There are many variations of these crests, and Pat drew out of that source in his work. And I know we would be watching some of these Japanese movies by people like Kurosawa. We weren't interested in the subtitles. We were interested in the banners.
We were interested in the visuals.
Yeah. And my heavens, were they wonderful visuals. And That's been part of Pat's work for years and years, that source of imagery that comes from the East. And he's not copy. He doesn't copy. He uses it to his own end. And he doesn't regard it as a religious thing at all. It's just that he likes the flat image. Mm. And it suits what he wants to say or not.
It's always part of some kind of shared aesthetic or, you know, sense of an aesthetic that he can really identify with.
That Eastern aesthetic, yes. He's always had that. He was asked what was the single most powerful influence. He said the Japanese flag, red circle, white background. You see a circle there?
You see
there?
It here. You see a circle screen, there. In a sense,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, the circle is a central motif in his work, the symbol of completeness, he has said before.
Sun and moon.
Too. Sun, moon, gold, silver. Always attracted to it. And the horizon. The horizon is very big in a lot of his paintings. It appears almost everywhere. That horizontal line. Which is not surprising. Because he grew up in West Cork. He's the son of a West Cork farmer. And from his bedroom, he looks out over Courtmacsherry Harbour. Directly out there, the Lusitania sank. He grew up with the view of the horizon, the sea. And that's not surprising that it's embedded in his consciousness. I stood with Nell Gooding, who's written an essay for this exhibition. I stood with him in Pat's studio, and Pat would have his chair at his table. To the left is a window frame, and to the right is a doorway with a half circle. Mel picked up on the framework of the door to the left and said, there's an echo of this in Pat's work. And I looked to the right, and above the door is the glazing slips in the half round top of the door, and they are Arcadia, the lines. And I hadn't seen that until Mel pointed it out, but it's so true. Sometimes what you see gets registered and then comes out in some other way without even knowing it, without always being conscious.
Of course, we also have in this space again some of that gold we were talking about, that the gold motifs, and behind us this beauty here,
this beauty,
this wonderful sensuous painting, the great shape. I mean, the half half circle and meeting again, the gold meeting a kind of muted silver, and a beautiful bend in it all that somehow it does.
I have the pleasure of living with this one down in West Cork. In my home, in my cottage, and it never ceases to please me. It's the gold, it's the tempera, it's gold tempera canvas. So many of the gold paintings are just that. Now, he's added color to some of them. He's added silver to some of them. But generally, they're gold tempera canvas. They're the parameters with which he elected to work within. But within those, he's playful, he's witty. It's always as if, having set the parameters, he can do what he like. And he has. He's continually tweaking but consistently finding a balance of just so, things just so, and no explanation. It's as if, and he doesn't explain. This is part of him. He's not going to do this. The viewer has to respond. And what the viewer gets is good. As far as Patrick Scott is concerned, that's what it is. And if it's Zen, fine. And if it's not, that's fine too. It's not for him, and he will not explain, because he doesn't have to. The work is there,
isn't it? Yes. This is the most important thing, is that the work is here to speak for itself.
Yes.
And in a sense, he speaks through it, if we're prepared to look and hear.
He speaks of quiet. He speaks of stillness. He's not a digger of the brain like Louis is, which is... that's Louis, and that's good too,
a
noble
yes.
thing too. Pat really speaks of... it's a mirror, really. It's the viewer meeting themselves, and he's not telling them anything other than what they see in themselves. It's their response for them. And
do you remember the first time you saw his work?
The first time I saw his work was probably in 76 and would have been a bog painting, which was the ones he did, you know, going down to Galway on the train, gazing at the bog. And he started painting, soaking the canvas with color and pigment. And they're wonderful paintings. And they are pre-60, pre-gold paintings. Later I learned that these were really just solutions. He was giving himself a problem and he was coming up with a solution. And as in everything that he... every problem that arose, he'd come up with a fairly simple solution. This was what he did. Fairly simple, fairly basic. And resolved in a different way. And he would do this and move on to the next one, set of problems that he's given himself to find a solution for.
This is what I find really, really interesting in his work as well, is the combination of fine art also and craft of somebody who really works to make the thing. And you have that sense of somebody, exactly as you say, working the thing out, you know, working out exactly what he wants to get.
Yeah. I wouldn't say Pat Scott is a visionary in that he doesn't have eureka moments. He goes to work and he believes in working. So he'd go to his studio and he'd sit there, and if something didn't come out of it, that's okay. And something did, albeit little, that's okay too. But he would go to work, and he believed in that. He also took great pleasure in process, in the tools associated with work. And this extended into his life and his collection of objects, which he has many of, his interest in vernacular, his interest in craft, his interest in design. For him, an implement became beautiful when it fulfilled its function well. And if it didn't, then it didn't have an inherent beauty. And it didn't matter what it looked like, if it functioned correctly, it had a beauty to it. And I think this informed his love of craft, his love of making, his enjoyment in making, his contribution to Kilkenny design was formed out of, you know, that whole appreciation of craft, function, form. That probably came from his training as an architect, his understanding of that. But he certainly reveled in it. You know, the butter churn, the spit, the noggin, they all did something. And therefore, they were nice things to have around. The meditation tables have a function. The screens have a function. I suppose the paintings the gold paintings, they also have a function, but the function is really for the viewer to draw onto themselves.
More abstract function, but no less valid for that.
No less valid. You see, he also loved, you see in this painting, I think it's called 38, Stevens' painting, and it's six tip, it's 6 4-foot square, and they're each one are the same.
Six panels about 4 foot
six
square.
Six panels, and it's a tile, it's repetition, and Pat liked that. He liked repetition, he liked pattern, and you see it in his tablecloths, gingham. You see it in a painting called Open Door. There's a tile to floor. You see it in a painting he did of Pat Mack called Rainy Day, which is essentially all leaf, the leaf of the building which was covered in ivy. Mm. And you see it through the work. Now, he moved away from all of these things. You know, he engaged with them, he indulged them, expressed them, but he moved away from them as well. He left them behind. Until we get to the last gold paintings, which are on this wall, the 3 4-foot by 2.5-foot paintings, which were the ones he did in 2009. And they haven't been shown before. They've remained in the studio on the wall as his friends, because he really enjoyed introducing the color black. And the black is, in fact, blackboard paint. And I'm not sure, I might be indiscreet here, but it is blackboard paint. It's a dense black, and it's matte. And again, we have 3 large gold discs, and we have 3 different treatments of the color black. And then on the third one, we have silver. The one in the center, which is just gold disc floating above a horizontal black band. There's no tempera in the painting. To me, this is almost the ultimate gold painting. It's the one that, it is the last one, but it just, for me, says this is the sign. This is what all the gold paintings have worked towards, this one painting. He's done a few after that, but they're smaller and they're more playful. This is the painting that, for me, it's the last most wonderful piece.
Encapsulates it all. It's very moving. It's a very, very beautiful painting. The 3 together, yes, have this extraordinary cumulative effect.
Yes. There.
I can see why he didn't want to let go of the film.
No, there was no rush to get rid of these 3. So, but I'm afraid they're gone now, out of the studio, and they're here for everybody to enjoy and see. And it's wonderful to see them surrounded by all the other ones. There is a painting here, which is a half circle of gold, and below it a column of thin lines of tempera. He was always practical. The reason why we've got these thin lines of tempera is because he discovered very thin masking tape. And he bought the stock of very thin masking tape and brought it into the studio and said, now, let's go. And this opened another door of the pictorial, but always within the confines of tempera gold canvas.
It's wonderful.
It's lovely.
Who would have thought the thin masking tape could lead to this? It's great.
This,
it's wonderful.
And you see this with the thin masking tape, he was able to make circles with it and quite tight arcs, because it allowed, so this opened up more avenues, and he explored it, and then I think the masking tape ran out. And so that was that.
Of course, it can't really be recycled not so easily.
No.
Has he talked about this show at all? I mean, presumably he's very glad it's happening.
He's very glad it's happening. He He hasn't talked so much about it because I think he's waiting to get a look. He knows the work. He knows it very well. It's there. He won't want to be talking about it because he thinks that's for others. And he hopes everybody enjoys it and hopes it'll be good enough. He's very modest. He hopes it'll be good enough.
What has Patrick's work meant to you? I mean, I know that's a huge question, and I know that, you know, you would be one of the people closest to him in life. I suppose one can love a person and love their work almost as two separate things and that are connected. Sure. But in terms of the work, what has that meant to you?
Well, it's influenced the way I approach my work. And I think when we go up to the gestural drawings, I'll be able to, because I was very intimate in that process, I'll be able to share with you something about how to approach work. And so shall we go
yeah,
up
let's
and
go
look
on.
At
yes, exactly. Let's go, and, let's go yeah. and look and talk. In that yeah. context actually yeah. makes, sure. makes sense. Yeah.
Patrick knew Michael as a schoolboy. And they both actually went to St. Columbus together. And Patrick saw his potential as an 18, 16, 17-year-old. And he wrote a letter of recommendation to an art college in the UK saying, I think you should look at this young man. And I think Michael went on from there.
And I think, did Michael borrow money from his father, I think, quite early on to buy one of Patrick Scott's paintings?
Oh, I think so. Yeah. And he's got a device painting, yes. which is on show in this yeah. in this gallery yes. now.
I think it's his father who just gave him the money and then got a bit of a shock when he saw the painting.
Ah, yes.
A good shock.
Yes. Yeah. Here we are with the gestural drawings. Mm. Now, what are these? They're ink on Ingrid's paper. In 1976, we went to an exhibition in the National Gallery of drawings by a German painter called Julius Bizier, who, these were very small drawings on paper and linen, and very beautiful. And at the same time, there was a Japanese artist, a woman, demonstrating her skill. She was seated on the floor. She had her ink, she had her calligraphic pens, she had a paper in front of her. She would invite a question or a subject from the audience, such as a bird on Stephen's Green. She would focus, she would wait, and then very quickly she would do a drawing in ink. And it was a bird in a park. But it was a very fast action, but a very intense concentration. I remember Patrick saying that this was not dissimilar to the way he approached the gestural drawings. So he would do the gestural drawings up in Wicklow, and he would do them as a way of unblocking what he felt was a block, a creative block. They're unlike the gold paintings in that they're not considered beforehand. Now, up in Wicklow, there's a pole with a piece of cotton attached to it, about 2 foot long, and the cotton would be about that as well. And the end would be frayed. So he would hit the paper with this. I think I'm the only person who assisted once by taking page after page. It came in a bundle of 100. And I moved them so that he could continue the gestural action. I also witnessed the editing of them. And of the 100, you might put one to the left, two to the right, another one to the left, three to the right. Of the 100, I think about 30 were acceptable. The ones that weren't acceptable were used to light the fire. I never quite understood, I never quite got it, why, what made the difference between them? What was acceptable, what wasn't. But this was his editing process. And there was a further one where he would decide which was the top and which was the bottom. And the signature would then be on the bottom. And that would be another editing of the image. What Pat was doing then was emptying the mind. I recognize this because as a swimmer, I was swimming up and down lanes. When you get your technique right, you don't think about it. All you think about is the thoughts, all that you observe are the thoughts coming into your head to suggest that you might stop, to suggest that there's something cooking, to suggest that breakfast is on the way, to suggest that pain is happening and you would need to stop. And we called it taming the monkey. The thoughts come through and you've got to be able to show them the door and just observe. That's something that Patrick Scott has. And he didn't get it from athletics. I'm not sure where he got it from, but I've watched him in his studio contemplate and be quiet and empty the mind. And the gestural drawings were a way of doing, had that empty mind and they were automatic. But in the studio when he's thinking of the, whatever the paintings are, he just sits quietly. And it's a form, it's meditation, it's contemplation, but it's not there's no religiosity attached to it. This is just
clearing the space to make.
And so I was always in awe of that quality, ability that he had.
And did you find that that began to influence you in the way you work, in your own work?
Oh, to the extent where I wasn't afraid of that process. And I remember making bowls, big, very large carved bowls, and which required hours and hours of work. And the mind would be emptied. You do it, you just work away. Not so much as a designer, but as a maker in the making, in the business of making. Yes, sure. Steady, calm, create the environment and work within it. Set limits on what you would do and work within that. And play within that. And yes, it certainly would influence. I got that from hanging around in the studio.
On the wall behind us, this great panel, as it becomes, of the Christmas cards that Patrick designed over the many years for Scott Town Walker. And they're splendid. And again, this flash of colour and wonderful, wonderful images.
Well, there again, it's his joy in colour and his ability to mix colour with abandon and have it work. It just works. They go from 75 to a year ago, and that's 36 years. And you can see somehow or other the interests throughout the decades that he was... that he was coming in and out. He lost his way. They were supposed to look like trees. Somewhere 8 years ago, they didn't. They started to look like curtains. But he came back to it. And they're very joyful. He enjoyed doing them. And they really come from a tradition that in his studio, prior to 75, he was doing cards for Michael Scott. He was doing small cards, and they're wonderful. I think some of them are going to be up in the IMA building. So there was a tradition, and there were cards that came in from others. So there was this thing in the 50s where people made their own cards and exchanged them. And there's some lovely, witty ones. And so that was an ongoing thing in his life. But I think this is very successful. It's the grid. It's 36 of them. And they are beautifully presented here.
Can we look at Mount Fuji across from
Fuji?
Us? Yes.
Well, here, these three paintings, we have two-foot square ones and 1 4-foot square one. The two on either side of the 4-foot one were from a series he called Windows on the World. He'd been in Japan, and the whole series were really quite pictorial, and they show that he could do the pictorial, but it was all within this wonderfully, it's architectural, there's vanishing points, there are views from windows or doors. Fuji is Fuji, it's so associated with the whole Eastern aesthetic. This rock garden, the single rock, there is a garden in Japan which is 13 rocks, but you can never see all of them at once. And that's a very Zen thing. And the large one in the center is from a trip he did in the 80s with a team from Kilkenny Design to China, and they ended up down in Kowloon, I think. And there's a range of mountains there which are quite spectacular and pointy and curvy. And here, again, he had the very narrow masking tape. And so he's using it with abandon. And it's very free.
There's lovely swirls.
Swirls.
Yes, beautiful shapes. And I love the way in the Mount Fuji painting that it's framed through, again, this kind of classic Japanese shape.
Yes.
An entrance, exit. See, we're looking at it in under cloud, and it's this glimpse. Of, yes. In a way, it's almost like a glimpse of the eternal. I mean, it's muted, and it's so contained somehow.
Yes.
It's a beautiful, beautiful paint.
There was a few more of those. He did Bog in Wicklow, I think. And there was a lovely set of 12, and they were snapped up straight away.
He was
very happy making those.
Mm. He didn't actually go to Japan until what, in the 1980s, was it?
Oh, not until he was well over 50. Mm. I think he went to Japan then, and he did a round-the-world trip, Mexico, South America. He'd always wanted to go, but he didn't go until later in life. So he wasn't influenced by his first trip to Japan. The appreciation of the aesthetic was always there. And it just became more so when he started going. He went back a few times. I think he went back with Stephen to look at the cherry blossom in spring. That's always there. That was always in the air.
Yeah, I think we should all do that.
Maybe. We should all do that.
If we could. Shall we look at some of the tapestries?
Shall we?
Yes. Oh, we should actually do it. Yeah,
While we're here, this is his collaboration with Stony Road. And they're prints, and these are the meditation series. And I think these are a wonderfully successful venture he did with a printer called James Nolan, and who's an artist himself, but he's an extraordinary facilitator of artists in this print studio, Stony Road, where they don't try to impose their style on the artist. They let the artist come in and they respond to the artist and change their own production methods so that they draw out of the artist something. And Pat had started with James doing some tangram prints, two of which are outside, I believe, and then one more print. And Pat felt very comfortable with James. And then James suggested this box set. It became known as the Meditation Series. And one of the issues for Pat was how to print gold. And the solution for Stoney was, let's apply it by hand and not print it. So this meant an awful lot of work on their part. They had a great gilder called Kelvin Mann who took it on. And the set of prints pick up on Pat's, for want of a word, pictorial world. And they just are so calm. The red one, the two red ones, they remind me of mandalas. And of course there's the disc and there's the pressed paper, which is a wonderful, subtle innovation of that gives a lovely quality. That was a new departure. I remember in the 80s, this interest in mandalas. In the Douglas Hyde, there were a bunch of Tibetan priests brought in, I think four or five of them, and this very large mandala was created using the very fine pigments. And it took months, and we were all visiting, watching how they were doing, and it took them a month or two, and it looked wonderful. And then they carried it down to the River Liffey and threw it into that. And the whole idea that you can spend all this time making something and then discard it, it was just to be celebrated. We liked that. We thought this is wonderful. That nothing is permanent.
Nothing's perfect.
But yet this mandala was done with so much care and so much love. And it was just the energy that went into it. It was just, we liked that. And that's getting back to the emptying the mind, that if you're that person doing it, you're doing this and you're just doing the same thing with slight variations, and you're just going on and on and on, and then you walk away.
No beginning and no end.
No beginning, no end. Just
it. It's the eternal.
It's
yes.
The eternal.
Yes.
Yeah.
The eternal river.
These are the two Tangram prints. Tangram's a Chinese game of shapes, and I brought the game into the studio in the 70s, and the little book. Now, I brought it into Patrick's life because Tangram is essentially a black tile cut up into diamonds and rectangles, and you very quickly, it's used as an educational tool where you can make shapes, and a lot of the shapes are of cats sitting or dogs jumping or human beings with little hats, and they're quickly done and quickly discarded, and then off you go again. And it's an educational tool, and we had a book showing all these little potential illustrations, and we would just play with it. And the next thing Pat Scott's doing, prints. And he's taking, these are some of the essential shapes, but not all of them. So he's just being playful with it. And
it's like origami, isn't it? That sense of the folding. Yes,
got that,
yes,
the folding,
wonderful
thing.
Folding. Mm-hmm. Paper, beautiful.
But he did it. And then he moved on, as he did.
Again.
Again, to something else, and treat it playfully.
Yeah.
It's nice to see them.
It's great to see it all.
Isn't it? I'm so glad the Christmas cards are here.
Yeah,
because they really show off his the abandon he would treat colour with, and the fun he had with it. Super, see them.
And I think the exhibition in the two places will bring his work, you know, really strongly back into consciousness and public focus, and probably also bring it to a new generation who are not so aware of all that he's done.
Yes, and I think his work will crosses over generations. I think Christina Kennedy, who's curated this exhibition, has told me that a lot of the young students who come in on tours look to Patrick Scott as a guiding light in terms of being relevant and somebody that they look to in their I want to know more about. And I think this is a great opportunity to see the diversity of his work, because he's known for the gold paintings, but he's not known for Christmas cards, and he's not really known for gestural drawings, and he's not known for the tapestry work.
Or that's the tables.
Tables.
Yes.
Or his enjoyment of, you know, or the way he just got on with things. And you know, there's no magic here. He's a worker. He works hard. He's a son of a West Cork farmer, you know, and he has that get to work ethic and solve problems. And he said about young people being artists, what would he say to them? I think he said, go to work. You know? I think Michael Warren quoted in Picasso saying, inspiration exists, but it must find you working. And it's very true.
Yes.
It's very true. You just, it's important.
Yes.
Now, this is where the fun begins. This is where the color explodes. This is the room where some of the tapestries hang. Some were made in Aubusson, the woven ones, and the tufted ones made in... I'm wrong. They're all Aubusson in this space. Winter garden, blues and greens. This one is Lansdowne, if I'm not mistaken. The red and greens and dark blues. This one is Lissenfield. These are places named after the locations where they were put. That was the Hetherington's inner garden in Heytesbury Lane. This is belonging to the Downses, and it's called Lansdowne and Lansdowne Road. Lissenfield, I'm not certain. But it's got, he just names them after the places. This one is called Eroica. This was magnificent, commissioned by Ronnie Tallon for the Bank of Ireland on Baggot Street. And it certainly lights up that beautiful building. It's the most fantastic explosion of colour. And
stunning.
It's just stunning. It's stunning. And it's large. It's, God knows, 5 metres by... Three.
Yeah.
It's beauty. It's a beauty. Lovely to look at. Many sides to that man.
Many sides.
You know, this and ability to be very, very outrageous with colour, and yet to be very restrained with gold leaf and canvas and tempera. And for them to be two sides of one coin.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about him growing up by the sea and that view of the sea, because somehow in some of the work, even in this, somehow this is a sense of marine life and here too. I mean, and that may be accidental, it may not be intended at all, but you know, the way piece can set off something in your mind and yes. Association you're not quite sure
yes.
why, and I guess that's the power of one of aspect of the power that it holds.
There's definitely, I mean, that thing about the horizon line is very much influenced by the landscape he grew up in, love of nature. But he did get out of West Cork when he was 18. He had no interest in the farm. His elder brother did, and that was that. He wanted architecture, and he wanted the arts. And as soon as he came to Dublin in 1939, that's what he immersed himself in. He wanted to be an artist before anything else. Certainly, he was able to stop being an architect in 1960, at the age of 40. I sometimes feel he was an architect only because he had to earn a living. He takes very seriously the whole idea of being an artist, and he takes it as a responsibility. And over a 75-year career, I think he's discharged that responsibility very well. And I don't think anybody's going to question that. They're just going to go, wow, all that stuff, and done with joy and modesty and love and And where did it all come from? Well, it came from everything he looked at. He'd see something and he'd turn it around and create something fresh. And it's a great lesson.
It must be very moving and very gratifying to see all the work come together like this.
It's very moving. It's very moving. To stand in this room with the tapestries is very moving. To walk around that bigger room inside with the canvases, it's extraordinary. Yeah. And yet the guy never boasted. He never made a big issue. I think Mel Gooding, in his essay, says the only reason why Pat Scott isn't acknowledged as an artist who has transcended national and international claim is because he didn't bother to tell anybody. That's the mark of the man. He's just got on with it.
The work tells it, though.
The work kind of tells it, yeah. Yeah, when you look at the whole body of work, and you see this, the beginnings, you see these interests in the orb, the naive animals, the architectural influences there, and all the time he's letting go of these things as through the decades, and letting go and just waving them goodbye, not just casually saying, okay, bye-bye, and on to the next. But there's a process of letting go all the time. And to get back to that painting with the black border and the gold disc, it's almost like that's where it's all come to. And all the rest is just part of the journey. And it has been the journey of his life. That's where he's at. And he can look it all back, look back and go, these foolish things. And that's what he's doing.